This podcast doesn't receive a lot of emails from people. Every once in a while, somebody will drop a note to say something nice or plug a playwright they would like to hear interviewed, but most of the time people connect with me through social media. However, I did receive an email recently. It was something. This person, who I did not know, called the opening to a recent episode of the podcast really, really embarrassing. Like, literally, quote, really, really embarrassing. And that is just the first line of the email. This person then called me narcissistic and juvenile. Juvenile? All in the first two sentences of his, the first two sentences of this person's email. Turns out, this person doesn't want to hear me talk at the beginning of episodes. This person said they did not know me, therefore they found no relevance to my stories. And I get it. It's not for everybody. The thing that I found hilarious is that this person's opinion about the podcast was based on not knowing me, yet this did not stop him. I mean, this did not stop this person from sending me insults. This person wanted to teach me a lesson, which came in a follow-up email explaining to me how podcasts work. This entire exchange had me thinking about the concept of criticism. I don't think this person shares any attributes with an actual critic, perhaps accepting those that criticize without invitation. It has me thinking more specifically about the toxic person-sculinity that is abound in the critical world and how that sort of behavior informs the way people respond to plays, movies, podcasts, etc. There is an undercurrent of joy in the way a thing or a person can be cut down, and an entitlement to do so. I heard a story about the famous food critic Jonathan Gold, who passed away in 2018. He would try and find small, unknown restaurants off the beaten path in the Los Angeles area, on the search for something great. And, it is said, if he didn't like the place, he wouldn't review it because he didn't want to harm a restaurant that was trying. I personally don't criticize much. I'm not afraid to express my opinion. I just think, if I don't like something, I can move on to the next something. Not everything in the world is made for my enjoyment. Hey everybody, I am Brian James Polak, and this is The Subtext, brought to you by American Theater Magazine. For this month's episode, I traveled to Brooklyn, New York, to hang with the awesome Crystal Skillman. Crystal Skillman is an award-winning playwright. Her plays include Geek, Cut, King Kirby, Pulp Verite, and Rain and Zoe Save the World, which was the winning script for the 2018 Earth Matters on Stage New Play Competition. Her play Open just debuted this summer with All for One Theater Company in a co-production at the Tank Theater, earning her a fourth New York Times Critics Pick. Now, all of these episodes of The Subtext are my favorite, obviously, but this one is a new kind of favorite because we recorded it outdoors on the Brooklyn waterfront. That's why you will hear helicopters, construction, and all other sounds of city life going on around us. Here's me talking to the lovely Crystal Skillman back in early July.
So anyway, we'll see how it happens.
Are we on the air?
We're on the air, yeah. We're broadcasting live from, where are we?
This is Borm. We're in Brooklyn Heights. The pier is Pier 3, I think, by the water.
Yeah, this
in
is
Brooklyn.
This is the first time I think I've recorded one of these in the outdoors.
I know, and we're like hidden. There's like bushes around us, and we're in a secret, it's almost like a secret garden, and there's a picnic table, and it's very cool. And helicopters are circling around us.
Yeah, we'll hear some.
Doing.
We'll hear some helicopter. We'll hear some city life periodically as we're talking, which is cool. Do you know what this place was originally?
I think they built out from it. So I'm not sure if the pier, maybe the structure of the piers was here, but there was no...
It was like shipping.
Yeah, there was no plans like here. Each pier is different, and like there's a sports pier, and then there's like, you know, a playground kind of pier. There's actually a roller rink here as well. We are in the area that I like to call the silent running pier. For this, anyone who likes 70s films, I think I got the name right. Because this is a pier all filled with trees and plants, and it's right. Almost like you're on the spaceship of Silent Running in the future, where those are the only plants that live. And this guy has to take care of them, and he goes crazy and he kills the humans because the plants are more important. Which is a very, very cool 70s message.
Right, right. How long have you been living in Brooklyn?
I've been here since... since 97 in different places, but I've been in this neighborhood since 2001.
Oh, so you're a long timer.
I'm a long timer, yeah.
So you've been witnessing the...
the changes.
The change, right?
Changes. I mean, for good and bad, you know, when, Fortress of Solitude is a really great book, but it was made into a really amazing musical, that Itamar Moses did the book for, mm-hmm. that I love, and he writes for the civilians. He's no longer with us. The composer. We'll put it in later.
Right,
it's like escaping
right.
me. Terrible. I will fix this. I saw that musical, and it's on Dean Street. It's set on Dean Street, and Dean Street's like right around the corner from me.
Mm-hmm.
And it really tackles gentrification. And as I was watching that musical and I've read so many books, I was really struck by, geez, how much, you know, I'm a part of that and what the neighborhood used to be and what it's become.
Yeah.
I am across the street from a very famous house in Brooklyn called the Mosaic House that my friend Susan created. Susan Gardner, she's a great artist. And so the outside is all mosaiced.
Yeah.
Like a big art piece, and people come to look at it. But she has a book that also, it's all illustrative. It's almost like a big journal where she kind of documents as well how, you know, she said the Latino woman used to be hanging out of their windows and families were running up and down the street. And it was just a very different vibe. So it's Brooklyn changes, but at the same time, you blink and then all of a sudden the mom and pop stores become like, you know, Barney's Co-op, you know.
Right.
So it's very interesting.
Yeah. There's a first helicopter. What prompted you to come here when you first moved to New York?
Well, you know, I really, a few reasons. Love was one of them.
Yeah.
because I was at Parsons School of Design in the city, and I met Gretchen Van Lente, who became my best friend. And she introduced me to her brother, Fred Van Lente, and said, well, you guys should be together. It took a little time, but eventually we did get together and realized that we really dug each other. And so he lived in Park Slope. So that's kind of how I ended up. So I was graduating.
Yeah.
And I was like, we've been together. Guess what? Now I'm going to live with you. And I, you know, I think Fred was like, oh, yeah, right. That seems like the natural next step. I think things are just happening. So then I'm living in Park Slope. And he's living, he writes for comic books. He still does. And he's writing novels now. But with a couple of amazing comic book creators would be coming in and out of those houses. There were a couple. One was... Ryan Dunleavy, and Ryan draws Action Philosophers with him, so I became very close with him. Steve Ellis, who has a lot of great books. I think it's the something about the boy living in the universe. Oh my God, I have to fix that too. Steve, I'm sorry, I'm coming back for you. but doing terrific work. And then Jamal Igel, who's always been doing is an amazing comic book artist. So literally, like, I would walk in and out of rooms and people were always making comics, like creating comics,
were
or
you
freaking
into,
out about comics.
Were you into comics at the time?
I came from like the Art Spiegelman kind of world, in that sense that, like, you know, as an artist, someone who studied visual art, I was very passionate about comic book and graphic novels being art. And I was so excited to see Art Spiegelman's pages on the walls of MoMA. And I think I saw that like when I was like 19 or 20,
mm-hmm.
like that happened. And that exhibition was a big deal because it was, I think, one of the first times that, you know, it was really being addressed that this is art.
Right.
At least at the level of the Museum of Modern Art for snobbery or non-snobbery or artistry sake. of course, Will Eisner and I think other pages by Jack Kirby had been on the walls before, but maybe not elevated to that extent. So I came at it from the more graphic novel-y world, but I think it was when Fred handed me The Watchmen. I hadn't read The Watchmen until I was with Fred, and that kind of was life-changing. And,
yeah.
And I realized how much you could control time, talk about memory, go in and out of moments, hold a moment, go faster and deeper in the storytelling based on the writing and the drawing. So it just was really, really.
Were you writing at the time?
I wasn't writing comic books, but I was writing
plays. Were you writing
plays? Yeah, because so the thing that happened was that I was a theater minor. Mm-hmm. And so I was interning. When I came to New York, I was interning at Ensemble Studio Theater in Circle Rep. And it's really interesting because I didn't know I was a playwright. I was writing plays, but it was people around me that felt very passionate about them that said, "You're a playwright." So Kurt Dempster ran EST at the time. Read a play. I was an intern. He got his hands on a play and he said, "You're a playwright. I'm putting you in Youngblood." And so that just happened. And so I had my first Times Review 2 years after I first started writing plays. Like I don't think I really clocked what was happening.
Wow.
You know, because
yeah.
I really was coming at it as an artist, and I loved being in Youngblood, and I was in there with Chris Shin and John Belusso, who's no longer with us, but a very close friend of mine. Francine Volpe I met there, David Zelnick, and he's got a great podcast, audio drama, going on right now, but also writes a lot of musicals. And so, and Chris just had a revival of Dying City,
right.
Second Stage,
right.
Which is a great, great play. I loved the world I was in. I loved, but I always was coming at it from a very artistic point of view. I think it's later on how to make a living from it that I started to think a lot about these practicalities between art making and showing, I guess, so
right.
to speak. So, you know, in a weird way, like, when I teach out and teach what I've learned, I think in a way because I was an outsider, I was able to see how a system in quotes business,
yeah,
because it's not really business, but it is a business, was working. But I wasn't taught any of that or shown any of that. I really just came in for the love of it. And I had a very visual sense to my work because I was a photographer. So, I mean, it was, I've always had capacity for language and dialogue and storytelling, but I think in the beginning my plays tended to be more visual. So when I realized that the people that were producing them early on were set designers and lighting designers, and I realized that they weren't maybe, that the actors weren't quite getting what they needed out of the scenes, maybe because they weren't clear enough, you know, as I was a younger writer.
Right.
I started to make a shift into then studying a little bit more formally through workshops, playwriting itself. So I was in the game. I was like learning out loud, so to speak, and people were watching me. Now, of course, I picked people to learn from, like Mack Wellman. So
right.
I had a long journey where I was like, I want to go more into the artistic, you know, soul of writing. So I really got a great balance between the people surrounding me, who I didn't realize they were mentors at the time. Like, you know, Christian was a mentor. John, when he was here, was a mentor. You know, because, you know, Francine has become a mentor. You know, because all these people cared and they will talk to you about their work and you're studying their work. And so by doing that, you're self-learning.
What were you doing as a child? Were you into the arts?
So many things,
like,
Brian.
I'm curious to connect you, the young you, to the playwright you of today. Did you grow up in an artistic household?
Well, I had, they weren't like, okay, so you read Rain and Zoe Save the World.
Right.
So that actually is like a family play for me. And so it's so, when we, you know, I have been known to say I hate naturalism. I don't hate it. There are naturalistic plays I really like. But I would argue that I don't, if you really analyze any play, what is naturalism, right? Because it's the natural world of the play. So Rain and Zoe, in Rain and Zoe, there's a lot about stealing a motorcycle, from a dad and the love affair of the father who comes back as kind of a ghost in this play. My dad is alive, but this is actually a true story that my dad stole my mom away on a motorcycle in Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And so they ran off together. I kind of want to write a short film at some point about the husband because I found out about him later. I didn't know that she was married at the time when I was a kid.
Your mom was married.
My mom was married, yeah.
When she met your dad.
Yeah, and he was a race car driver. So he had a race car, and he was parking the race car in their garage, and then he also had a motorcycle. And he said, "Do you want to take a ride on my motorcycle?" And then, like, 3 days later, they ran off together. That is how the story goes. I did not know the story at the time. I discovered it later. So I was raised by a race car driver. So I was sleeping on the stands. I was like, I just had this kind of kooky world.
Where were you?
We were in California. So I was in San Diego until I was six. And then I think one of the most iconic things that happened as a kid was this cross-country trip. So they decided... my dad was trying to figure out how to make money.
Yeah.
So much, you know, I mean, the good thing about struggling with money that I saw with my parents, as hard as it was on them, was that they always had this philosophy. And, you know, sometimes it's bitten me in the butt because I might have been a little bit more practical in the beginning, could have been easier. But they were like, money isn't real. It's not like they said that, but they were like, do what you want and the money will come.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just grew up with that philosophy. And so my dad found some jobs with trucking in New York. So he then basically took us in a station wagon, like a Ford station wagon. I had two kittens at the time, so I was in the back seat. That was my world.
And how old were you?
I was like 6 or 7.
Okay.
And so it was like 12 days cross country. And we were towing the race car.
And you were en route to New York?
And to New York. We ended up in Carmel, New York, because we had some relatives there, and they kind of helped us out. And then eventually ended up in around Poughkeepsie called Wappingers Falls. And that's pretty much where I grew up from, like, I don't know, age 8 on until I came to New York City. There was a Connecticut stint where I did go to the Hartford Art School in Hartford, and that was actually super helpful. So that was my first step out of upstate New York. But I had such a connection with the city because we would come up all the time. We would come up to see plays. We would come up to see art. And so, you know, I was quite often in the city when I was little.
So at that age, when you were coming into the city to see plays and art, et cetera, what were the things you were thinking about that was inspiring you? Were you like, I want to be a painter when I grow up? You know, did you have those thoughts?
I was always torn because I was doing theater since I was like really young, like 5, like in these like community groups, you know,
right.
Like, but I was like a squirrel or something, you know?
Right, sure.
And so I loved theater so much, and I was reading plays a lot, and I'm not sure exactly how that happened, but I liked dialogue a lot. So I liked that's kind of why I think I like comic books so much too. Like I have trouble, I love novels, but when it gets a little like, oh, the trees and the wind and the Silver Lake, and I'm just like, oh my God, can't we just be at the Silver Lake? Can I read that as a visual? And like, can't they talk? Can't
right.
they? So I was really, really into dialogue. I was reading a lot of screenplays and things like that. So, you know, I had this love of theater, and I was always in these groups. At the same time, I was always painting. I was always drawing. And I loved photography, which I think came from my dad because he had an old camera, and I got that camera. And I love the process of the old film, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, kids. Digital's great, and, you know, you see me on Instagram, you know, I love it. I love it. It's like the modern Barbara Kruger, but, you know, there was something about this process of creating something in that little box, and you didn't really know how it was going to turn out until you got into that room, and it was like a whole, and what you were going to do with that and your decisions of how you were going to print and what it was going to be. And so I loved being in the dark room. I loved it very much. Like, it's almost like how I feel about writing. It's just such a spiritual action. You're seeing something emerge like magic, like it was there, but it's not there.
Right.
It wasn't there before,
yeah.
But it was always in your mind, and
yeah.
You saw it, and you know, you captured it. So I really didn't think about choosing. I always kept thinking, you know, about creation. I really didn't think, and kids, not sure if this is a great idea, but I didn't think a lot about how I was going to make money from any of it. Like, I didn't think about it at all. I remember I thought abstractly that I would be a photographer's assistant. And I did go. There was some, a woman who loved me, and so I came out to New York, and
not a photographer, but a photographer's assistant.
Well, as a job. Like, I figured,
okay,
like, that would be,
okay.
Like, of course, I wanted to be a famous photographer, and I wanted to have my Wicked MoMA and all that stuff.
But you'd pull the money from being the assistant.
Yeah, I thought that's what I would do. Or studio work, and so I did shadow in both those circumstances, and I didn't like it. Like, I didn't not like it. People loved me, and they were really kind. Like, it was a good scene. Like, I dug it. I just was like, oh, the studio thing is just about the lights and the, you know, it's just about, you know, it's something else. It's really creating something so that someone can sell it. And I wasn't sure. That didn't seem to jazz me. And then that was basically in a studio where they were shooting products and things like that. And then the other one was She did these amazing, the reason why I picked her, she had a usage of something I was obsessed with at the time, which is a 20x24 Polaroid camera, that the camera itself was that big. And she had done these iconic shots of tattooed women and displayed them in color, and they were really great. And I loved her. I spent 3 days with her in her studio. I slept on the couch. She was like kind of priming me. But I realized that you had to be really meticulous. Like, you couldn't fuck up. Because it's like, you would fuck up her stuff.
Right.
And I have a lot of honesty about what I'm really good at and what I'm not good at. Which I can only describe that once I tried one day working at the farmer's market, and I was having a lot of fun. And then they were like, now you need to work the register. And I was like, oh, you mean I have to handle the money? Like, I have to decide, like, I have to give it back. And I saw the farm going up in flames, and I said, I'm so sorry. I can't do this.
You saw the whole future.
I saw your farm go up in flames. I knew it. And so, I've grown more meticulous in my work, but I'm a bit of a dreamer. And so I'm aware, like, maybe I shouldn't be in charge of the money right now at this point in my life. Maybe I shouldn't be in charge of your slides and not fucking them up so I can get a job. So then I kind of realized, I was like, well, what can I do? Like, and then that was kind of, as that was happening, I was being put into these playwriting groups. And so that kind of started to lead on this road of writing. And so, and I still wasn't sure where that was going to go, because as you and I know, you know, playwriting, so great, but doesn't necessarily make the big bucks, especially when you're young.
But if you are not a person that is thinking in terms of how to make money, it's perfect for you.
Yes. I had no, and when Fred really met me, I kind of had that too. I was just kind of like, I think, you know, it's funny because all the questions I look back and people were kind of asking me, I was like, oh, everyone was like really, like, knew I was exciting and excited by me, but they were worried. You could just tell, like, where are we going, friend? What's happening, friend? But I didn't see any of it. I was like Mr. Magoo. I was like, whoa, you know, I'm going to create this and create that. If you believe, it'll come, you know, kind of a thing.
What were you writing in those first plays when you were, like, in Youngblood?
I wrote a play that I was really proud of, that actually when I worked on Open, the recent play that happened in New York, A Magic Show Without Magic, this reminded me a bit of it. It's called Seven Variations on the Same Lover, and it was two people, and the woman stayed the same, and you saw the different people she was dating and with, but they were it was done almost like a circus act.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a guy playing the other roles, and then he plays the last lover, which is a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And so then it ends with that being the moment that really connects her. And so it was just a really, the way it kind of unfolded in these seven acts, I was really into that. I was really into structuring certain pieces. I guess I was into seven. There was a ballet in seven parts with no dancing, which was a relationship between very young, like teenagers, boy and a girl, and in between them was a record player. And they would switch the record for each scene, like the samba, the mambo, and it would be these different dances, basically. But they never moved. And it showed the demise of their relationship.
Had you taken any formal playwriting classes?
No. I didn't until I was is it called sophomore in college? Yes. I was like in a sophomore in college at the Hartford Art School.
Mm-hmm.
And I took as an elective playwriting with Edward Allan Baker. And that was the first time. So I was writing a lot of stuff. And also my work with photography was pretty experiential. Like, I would create kind of almost installations that had a narrative and a story.
Yeah.
They're a little bit lighter and funner than Cremaster. I love Cremaster. But thank you, Matthew Barney. But so they had like a humor to them, but they definitely were an experience. Like I was printing photographs on Christmas ornaments, and you would walk in this room, and there were these presents, and when you opened them, the photographs would be the only thing lining them.
Mm-hmm.
So they told a story, and like, you know, all sorts of worlds like that. And so in a way, then that text kind of got onto the page, but it wasn't until I was in Edward Allan Baker's class that I was hearing things like about the structure stuff. And before that, I did a workshop in Circle Rep, because they had a writing school with Mary Sue Price.
Mm-hmm.
And she actually has come back around. Both her and Edward have been so sweet. And they're like, we're so glad you're doing so well. But also, I knew when they had me in class, at least Edward, he was like, where are we going, friend? Little dreamer, what's happening?
I love that you already had sort of established in your DNA this... You weren't pinned down by the formalities of playwriting structure that tend to constrict early career playwrights or playwrights that are just learning the form. Like, you already kind of had this coming at it from a right angle.
Yeah. And it really has helped me as a teacher, as a kind of like, you know, person in the middle of the storm, so to speak, so that as people are considering MFAs and what they do, or, you know, talking about it after, maybe mm-hmm. it didn't happen the way they wanted to, and I can say, just hang in there, but also be free to explore things that in a new way, you know. And also talked about practicalities. I think it's great that we talk about you should have the two-person play, you should have the four-person play. I think it's great to address everything. I think it's cool. I didn't come at it from that place. I did think about doing different things. I tried to never do the same thing. I tried to always write different stories and different and say, how can I challenge myself in a new way? How can I tell a story that we haven't seen on stage before? I was thinking about the relationship of the personal and the kind of and a unique way to tell the story and breaking it down. So I feel like if, you know, sometimes MFA, even within being artistic, gets formulaic. And I know that because I'm like on the committee sometimes for reading selections, and I can tell right away. I'm like, this person just graduated from Yale. Like, I can just tell. Like, I just know. Some of it defies it, and it's great because that person has kept their voice but also taken a lot of advice. Right. And that's really what it is that balance. So for my students, I try to really be like, don't be afraid to go on your own path. Listen to everyone. Something that, a new trend that I saw, this isn't necessarily MFA, but it was happening with a few of my like early 30s students. And they started being like, well, I think I'm really ready because I've got this, the two-person play that does X and the four-person play that does X, or it has no set and it does X. And I just held their hands. I don't know what was in the air. It happened about 5 times in the past month.
Mm-hmm.
And I held their hands. I said, don't worry about any of that. And I said, don't lead with that. Because if someone loves your story, tell them the story.
Yeah.
That's how you get people invested in you and your work and the play. That's how you, I mean, for good or worse, sell a quote-unquote a play. And I don't mean sell in a dirty way.
Right,
I mean, find the people that want to invest in it or produce it or bring it to the next level or connect you to someone who can help you. But they don't do it because it's two people, four people, no set, one set, a moon, not a moon. They do it because you told them in just a few sentences something about the theme or the work or how it strikes your heart or how it speaks to the culture or what you're doing or the actual story that pierces their heart. And they say, oh my God, I want to see that. I want to see that live on stage. Then they might say, my budget is a two-person play. And then you say, shit, well, this one has 16 people in it, so let's talk about two. But it's something that I guess hadn't been talked about. But that's been my experience because, and I learned that from the musical theater world. When you were talking to people that want to invest in your work and produce your work, that they care about the story because they are going to give up a lot of money and they're going to give up a lot of time and a lot of effort. So if it's not a story that they can, like, passionately say, I wanted to see that story on stage, they're, you know, they have to care.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what makes people care is story. And we're living in a time where we're reanalyzing what empathy is. And I think theater has emerged as a huge tool for that.
Yeah, it's actually one of the positive things coming about in this era we're living through is the re-engagement with empathy. I mean, we're obviously revealing a whole swath of society that lacks it entirely. But I think there are a lot of people that are re-engaging with the concept of empathy and the power of it and the importance of it. And that wasn't happening, you know, 20 years ago.
Yeah, it almost feels like before, you know, and I love all plays, but, and you know, if you had to say certain plays of their time, it felt like the story was coming at you. And now I think people are really interested in theater, how the story is, how the audience is a part of the story and how the story is happening with you there.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember early plays that really captured your attention and made you think, I want to do that?
Yes. I was like an early teenager, maybe a preteen, and this was something I hadn't seen before, you know, because I was doing stuff like where I was a squirrel, or I was like a villager and like Pete's Dragon, and the first play that like knocked me off my socks was By the Skin of Our Teeth. So I was in seventh grade and our teacher was like, we're doing By the Skin of Our Teeth. And of course I was like, oh my God, there's mammoths and there's like, it's like the end of the world. It's like three acts. I don't even understand it, but I do understand it. And of course everybody wanted to be either a dinosaur or Sabrina. Like that was it. Like, you know, then there was everybody else. At least for the ladies. And And being in that play and that process really taught me a lot. We also wrote our own musical there. It was called Poughkeepsie Day School. There were no grades in that school. It was a really hippie school, man. It was really hippie. And it was great. You could have conversations where it's like, well, I don't know, but hey, friend, dreamer, you could be stronger in these roles. And I would be like, really? You think so? Let's talk about it. And it'd be like, everything would be like a little chat. And so
right.
You really were accountable for yourself. We wrote a musical called Quelque Fromage, which made no sense, but there was a song in it that my friend Gabe wrote, and it was at the time computers were becoming big at that time,
mm-hmm.
and he wrote a song, and I'll never forget it, and it just goes, computers, computers, the wave of the future, the power I hold will bring on wealth untold. Like, isn't, I mean, come on.
Am I going to have to owe him a royalty now?
You're going to have to owe him a royalty. Gabe, I don't know where you are, but that was amazing, and I've never forgotten it.
It's a check for 5 cents coming your way.
5 cents. So that those experiences were terrific. And then I saw a play called Break. This is the one when I was, like, a preteen in Woodstock. It's the first time I saw a show in the round.
Mm-hmm.
It was called Breaking the Code by Hugh Whitmore, and it was about Alan Turing. And it was told out of sequence his whole life. And he mm-hmm. played, the one actor played himself, but it was really complex. The language was beautiful. I didn't really know Alan's story, and it really ended with him in the circle with this apple, you know, this poisoned apple. The framework, I think also I'd never seen a play talk frankly about homosexuality and using the fact that it was banned and the fact that he was, you know, kind of being tortured in a sense,
mm-hmm.
A prisoner. And so that would go to those sequences. And I really was moved, I think, on several levels, the actual storytelling, the story of this person, the going back and forth in time, yet I understood it all. It wasn't confusing. I realized that. So when we talk linear and nonlinear, like what's easier to understand, I know very well, you know, you don't have to straighten something out to be understandable. It's really about the relationship of things together. And so if they work properly, you can tell a story any way you want, you know, and it will completely
right.
make sense. So there was that I really loved. And then also that it had a strong message. It had something to say. And I think By the Skin of Our Teeth does too, but that really struck me. For female playwrights, I first became, and now all I'm doing pretty much is reading female playwrights, so it's amazing. We're living in a heyday around us with my colleagues and those emerging. But it was Carol Churchill. The minute I read Carol Churchill, and I was in Cloud Nine
mm-hmm.
When I was at Parsons School of Design with the New School, I was in a production there with Soleil Moon Frye. Who is known as Punky
right.
Brewster.
Punky Brewster.
And she's coming back in a big way. Actually, I think she is directing or involved with the new relaunch. She's a real smart cookie. She played Edmund, actually, in it. I played the grandmother, and I played Betty in Act 2. I actually had a major role in Act 2. I mean, I still knew I couldn't act, so this was sad. I'm sorry, Carol. I'm so sorry. But I loved being in it because being in it taught me her work in a whole different way from acting in it. And I was also in David Mamet's Edmund, and I think that was the first experience I had. That was a show in Poughkeepsie. That was, again, I was like 18 or something.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, you know, whore number one or something. I'm like the waitress, the person who dies, the girl who dies.
Of course.
Of course. But it was the first time I roll. But the way the language was beaded, the heightened simplicity of it, and the director just saying to me, it was the first time I'd had a director say, because I really hadn't formally studied theater, you know, I was doing all these things. But he said, you get this isn't real life, right? You get this as heightened. And then there was something that clicked in me, like that felt right. And then Carol's work, which I think I encountered a little later, it's heightenedness but naturalness to me, like just knocked my socks off. And then I think the next woman playwright I fell in love with was Naomi Wallace.
Mm.
And I just, one flea spare, I'll never forget seeing that. I could watch that, you know, for on a loop for hours, and she always surprised me. And then I fell in love. I never saw it, but I fell in love with this play she wrote called Slaughter City. I read it almost like every 6 months. Like, I think it's one of the best plays ever written. And then I remember first with Lynn Nottage, the first time that I encountered her work, and every single piece. She always has so many plays, but particularly most recently, I just think it. I thought Malema's Tale was one of the most incredible plays, and the way it was done on stage was incredible, and its message and clarity and uniqueness to the form. It's about an elephant. It deals with environment and animal conservation, and you follow an elephant after he has been killed for his tusks, and he represents the tusks in the play through commerce. So every scene you follow where those tusks go.
Yeah.
And it's incredibly moving. And it deals with, being African-American. It deals with the diaspora. It deals with slavery. It deals with everything underneath all of these things, you know. So it's really a moving piece. So those are the lady that I consider the mentor lady voices that I've been circling around me, you know. And then, but if I went to, it's funny for, I can never put Thornton Wilder in the box of the older white dude, because he defied it for me, because I mean, our town's fucked up too. I mean, that guy was fucked up, and his stuff was so poetic and beautiful. It just has something so clear to say and so magical. So.
I mean, The Skin of Our Teeth to me is I can't believe that play was written when he wrote it, which was
I can't believe it either.
1930s. Right?
Yeah. There was no TV, so that was a big deal then. So people went and got awards and people noticed it. If it happened today downtown, I don't know what would happen.
I mean, people who haven't experienced this play or read it, check it out. It is the wildest play, sorry about the pun. But really, I can't believe it. I saw a great production of it at Artists Rep in Portland that Damaso Rodriguez directed, and it felt very much of today, despite the fact that this play was written 80 years ago or whatever. I don't know. And when I actually read it, I read it before I watched it, and I'm like, what is this? How is this a thing? And how did he write this? All that, he had a very similar, relationship to structure as you do. Right, which is to say that formal structure is unimportant.
Yeah, he has a collection that I found. I found this beautiful hardback book, and the pages hadn't been, in the old days, if you get a book from a bookstore where the pages are still sealed,
mm-hmm.
and so you had to open them basically that means for the younger listeners, the pages are connected, and so you have to kind of take a letter opener to kind of carefully open them and to read it.
Mm-hmm.
And so no one had really read this book, obviously, they had at the time. And it was his short plays, and he wrote them when he was 15, and there were 20 of them. Mm-hmm. And they were Angels Come on the Beach and just crazy, crazy shit. It was that, Edward Albee did it in that one moment with the lizards, but
right,
it was Thornton.
Seascape.
Yeah, there were plays where of puppet devils that were became real people. In essence, I think at that time, at least for the American canon, right, it was happening so much with Spanish writers and many, many other writers.
Right.
But magic realism was happening all over the place. It's so great. But he had quite magical stage directions. How the fuck would you do that?
Mm.
I do. I am still, that's my jam. I'm still really into how do you unpack a beautiful visual that's moving things forward, that is a part of the storytelling, and you don't need words.
Mm.
And I think that's what I love is that relationship. That's why I think one of my favorite plays, I didn't mention Paul Vogel, obviously, huge influence, and Indecent was one of the best things I've seen in the past 10 years.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. And that relationship and what Rebecca did to that relationship of the storytelling on stage, between what we see, what we hear, what we experience in different languages, how, why, and how structurally that pays off huge.
Right.
Hugely in that show.
When you were coming up and you were in these writers groups and those early plays that you mentioned writing, was there a moment when you started to feel like it was all coming together, you were getting this playwriting thing?
I think my instincts for what... I had a good instinct for subtext, speaking mm-hmm. of things, but for what was about and what was interesting to explore and what would captivate an audience. I didn't have the commercial sense, by commercial I mean in quotes, what is commercial?
Yeah.
But meaning, one of my best short plays was called Tooth, and that was what was done at EST in Youngblood. And I adapted it from a short story I wrote, and And that's true. Before playwriting, I took a great writing course called Accidental Realities. And it was like,
what is that?
It was like, it was like unleash the poetic in you and writing short stories. And like, and I took some novel writing classes. And so I was always highly poetic and was coming out on the page. So I knew that my growth in language was growing. But I thought Tooth was not a good play. Like, I didn't think it was a great play. And Chris Smith, who ran Youngblood at the time, was like, this is the play we want to do. This is the play we want to produce and highlight. And I was a little embarrassed. I was like, I don't know if this is good enough. Like, I don't know. Because I think in theater, sometimes it's hard when you have a lot of thoughts and you have a lot of deep thoughts. I mean, we all do. But you're trying to, if you can't put that all on stage. And you can't put it all on stage at the same time or same moment, obviously. Right. And so sometimes what is the most effective theater piece is actually quite simple on the page, or the idea of it's simple.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that this date that goes awry and this woman who seems like she can't articulate herself ends up telling the best story in this incredibly poetic way to this guy who's a writer trying on this first date, trying to school her, so to speak. And there's this comeuppance, and then you realize that the short story was actually in which she is hallucinating, her tooth has been taken out, but she's talking about family memories where she might have been molested. And the whole play ends with him saying, that's incredible, you're a writer. And she's like, she really doesn't comprehend that necessarily. And she's like, he's like, but is it true? Is what you said true?
Mm.
And it and there's these pauses, and she just holds her jaw, and she's like, oh, my tooth, it hurts. And he just, like, is there for... But, you know, it's clear the experience happened. Is her story and what she remembered exactly true? But I thought that was too simple. Even in saying it, it's like it's a lot to wield. But so I think that I knew that I had talent. I knew that there was something here. I knew people were moved by my work. Because yeah. that's really why I made the shift into playwriting. I was sensing that call. But I think I had a hard time understanding what should be up on stage when it should be produced, or the stages of that.
You mean like the stages of development of a play, like when a play
when
was really ready?
Yeah. And I think we all, I mean, I think for playwrights it takes like 20 years to really get that, because when you're writing, you want to see it done. And you should, and you, but it didn't even occur to me that you could do workshops, show it in a small way first. You could then grow from there. You can experiment in the room and rewrite in the room.
Mm-hmm.
And so that growth of knowledge happened, you know, about 8 years ago. And that's when I wrote, it was a little less than that, like maybe 6 or 5. I wrote Cut for, with Megan Hill, for the management.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I started to write with actors in the room, and also working with Daniel Talbot, because I did these site-specific plays, working with actors in the room, tailoring the pieces for a specific ensemble, that gave me a whole new arsenal of rewriting and writing tools, in which I wasn't just alone in my room wondering what worked and didn't work and had to send it out or find somebody. And so I realized that's how you create a community, and that's how you start to talk about the play and how you get people invested in the story.
Now, did that realization and connection with working with specific actors, did that change the stories you were telling? Or
yes.
Did stories... Okay.
I mean, I think the stories kind of stayed the same, but they got more grounded.
Okay.
Because the dreamer me was going more to the poetic, and it helped me ground a real world in my plays and then go somewhere else, and magic could enter. But we would talk through a lot of the given circumstances and the realities and the believability that doesn't always need to be on the page or in the play, but the team needs to know. And so I also understood the power that, like, if I don't want to be explicit and I want to let things hang out a little bit and then let the reality drop in the next scene, I can fight for that, because I, as the writer, know I'm doing that. But I have to articulate that, and that's what I'm doing. So it allowed me to be more articulate about what I was doing, and I think the actors changed the stories in the sense that the beats got stronger.
Right.
Because they would say, why is this happening next? How does it lead to the next moment? So it had less to do with story and much more about the things I hadn't formally studied, which was, or, you know, only gotten very quickly, which is structure, beat work, how dramatic action can sustain itself.
Mm-hmm.
So when I teach my students, what I try to really be clear about is that I draw a circle, and in the circle is the present, and then I draw the past on one side and the future on the other. And I said, the play is everything that happens in the present. And that's the dramatic action we work on, is to sustain that. The past is the 5 minutes before, and the history, that affects the present. and the future of where the characters want to go to and what they're striving for. That's the future.
Mm-hmm.
But all we see is what's in the present. So you only need from the past and the future what fuels the present and the dramatic action that of moving forward things in the present. And that can be any of your choices. And so we look at all the graphs. We look at structure. We look at hero's journey, anti-hero's journey. We look at all circles, you know, how, you know, mapping your work in different ways. But my point is that, you know, you someone may love Hadestown, and then somebody may love more Malima's Tale, right? Like, but the truth is, there is something that unites them, and that's in the present, and there's dramatic action moving it forward. So it doesn't matter. So you can write, you know, Brian, you can write a certain kind of play, and I can write a certain kind of play. But those are the things that we agree on, and it doesn't have to be a certain kind of shape, as long as mm-hmm. we have that. And I one of the examples I love to talk about is that I don't think anyone else ever saw this play. I'm sorry, Anne Bogart. Maybe they did. They probably did because it was New York Theater Workshop, but I haven't met them personally yet. And you did a play, Anne, called Bob, and it was about Robert Wilson, and it was at New York Theater Workshop. And it really was just you were with Bob for about an hour, and I can't even remember the actor so bad, but there was a sequence in which he was like, well, you know, everything you see and experience, you have to slow it down. You have to slow it down. And he had a pitcher of water and a glass. And then he slowly pours the water into the glass. And he slowly drinks it. And he does it again and again. And I could have watched that.
In silence?
Yeah. I could have watched that for hours. But that's dramatic action. He gives me a pledge. He gives me a promise. I'm seeing how it plays out. And in that, there's tension.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if your play doesn't build in a certain classic way, if your climax is more like an inward climax, that's awesome. But, like, that's really only our goal. And then I think the relationship of story and how you want to tell it is a part of making those choices. But what I do fight for is no repeated beats. The beats should be slightly different. I fight for that theater's about change. Maybe they don't change at the end, but I would argue that at Waiting for Godot, I believe they have changed in some way. Possibly the audience through the experience, but your relationship to, you know, you must consider those things. You must consider the audience. Make the audience as comfortable as you want. Make it as long as you want. I think that stuff's all great. But I do think you want to be aware of their experience with it. And that doesn't mean whether they like it or not. It just means that you're building something that they're a part of.
Yeah, I actually think that's a great message for writers just learning the craft, is that you have to realize that if you're writing drama, you're writing for an audience. And what you do with that information is up to you, but just be aware that you're writing something for people to then come see.
Well, and it's more, we can talk about it more openly now too, because there are such other mediums available to writers. I mean, yes, you have to get some investment money, make your own web series, find somebody, go out, be in a writer's room, you know, all the political stuff mm-hmm. you have to do to work at any medium. However, it's available to you. So if you would rather, if you're not as interested in the live audience response, film, web series, TV, comic books, right?
Books.
I would say the comic books is a little bit more live than TV or film because you have to turn the page. It does teach you, see, in theater and comics, because you can devour a comic, even a graphic novel, in one sitting. And you might be so engrossed that you don't want to put it down, or you put it down slightly, but you have, because there's something in your head that makes you grab it again immediately. I think, or it's just my relationship to that kind of storytelling. Screenplays the same way, even if I haven't seen it, just reading it, the dialogue hooks you in a certain way. I think novels teach you, you're engaged, but you may not have time to go back and read a whole chapter until, I don't know, 12 hours later, right? Maybe mm-hmm. you go to sleep, maybe, you know, you're at work or whatever. And so in a way, novel reading forces the reader to be more engaged because they're going to have to keep up that sustainability. It's not actually doing it for you. You've got to take some responsibility.
Right, right.
Because
yeah.
How many times, this happens to me all the time, how many times do I start and then I'm halfway and I'm so into it, man,
yeah.
and then something in my real life happens and I don't go back. And then I'm like, a week later, I'm like, wait, I want to go back. And I'm like, shit, I don't remember.
Where
do
was
I remember?
I?
Yeah.
And then that feeling that you had, you can't bring back. It's not there. It's gone. It's ephemeral.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you got to find some kind of relationship with that. So I think that's really, it asks a lot of work. The audience also has to work in a play, but a lot is done for you
yeah.
in a lot of ways. And so it's an experience that you can come to and be bathed in, so to speak. So.
Mm-hmm. I want to hear you talk a little bit about, I guess, you know, how you see your relationship to your career and you know, the kind of efforts it takes to make a career as a playwright?
Well, I think, you know, when I used to get a little bit more sulky when I was a younger playwright, and I was like, why?
Does that go away?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it doesn't. That's why I run. I would be more sulky if I didn't run. Actually, if I'm ever upset or I'm about to cry or anything, Fred knows, my husband, he's like, oh, you got to run. You got to run. I was like, I got to run. I got to go. I just run and it just comes out, you know, and it's great. And then it goes into something, which is terrific. And usually then it's like a catharsis. I have some good ideas actually as a result, because, you know, you should, I believe in being emotional. Like, I really do. I think I've understood through my interactions with business, there's a time and a place to be emotional. But I also think honesty is why we work with people. And we don't want to work with yes men, and we don't want to work with people who bullshit. You want people in the room that are going to tell you like it is, also at the right time,
mm-hmm.
and when it's appropriate, and if it helps you and it helps the play. But I teach like that too. So if a premise is not holding, if it could just be slightly stronger, I'll say, this is great, but I will open other roads the writer can see as a possibility, and then hopefully will make their mind go to another place, and or they'll fight in a way that makes the premise stronger, the what they want to do, because in justifying it to me, they understand more exactly what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in a way, almost like that's a good example of how I think, you know, in the beginning, because the business was so veiled, now luckily, and again, business in quotes, but how it works, the system is so... And systems, it's not just one, in theater is so veiled when you're a young writer. Mm-hmm. And it's very mysterious and it's very strange. And no one, at least now people talk about it. This generation of playwrights is talking about it and addressing it, because openly, from the theater makers to the artistic directors coming in, everyone is addressing that the system is somewhat broken. And it's something that is pretty transparent right now, which is kind of awesome. And broken isn't necessarily like, it's like, oh my God, we're all crying and everything's in flames. It's simply about certain, you know, not everyone is being seen, and why, and what does that mean, and what do we do? And there are now more plays than ever, and theater needs those plays more than ever, because people want that experience more than ever. Mm-hmm. So it's a whole new ball game going on. But so when I was coming up as a playwright, because that was so veiled, I really thought, you know, you just... I don't know, I thought it was like a Greek play, man. Like, I thought it was like Medea or something. Like, I thought I would raise my arms up, and the sun god would come and take me, and then it would be like, I'm off Broadway at Playwrights Horizons, and it would be like, you are. And then, like, someone else would be like, wow, as a result of that, mm-hmm. now you're going to be, we're going to do a 2-week limited run on Broadway, and be like, wow, that's great. And so, like, I just thought that there would be a cause, and like good writing,
right.
I thought there would be a cause and effect to my career. It's not that I saw it as a ladder. I did know that it's not ideal, there are ups and downs. Theoretically, I knew that. But as I was going through the ups and downs, I was like, how do I survive this? How do I understand? How do I make myself stronger? How does it help the work?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the only way, I think, to do it, is that how is... Well, first of all, we have a great gift, which is that anything good or bad that happens to us, we can make into something.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, we share it with others, and they can then go through that experience, and it helps them. And it helps alleviate how they're feeling. It helps them have an idea. It helps them be excited to do something in their lives that might change things, or how they act with another person, and all these sorts of things. So we have great power in that, like Spider-Man. With great power comes great responsibility. I was bitten by a spider. That's actually what happened. But so I started to understand how to use the downtime. And I think it's almost like prison. I know this is weird to say. I'm sorry. Playwrights like prison. But it you know, I had so many little islands of my career. So I started out by not really working for it, in a sense. So let's like analyze that, right? 2 years playwriting. I have a New York Times review with my short play, because I had not formally, Edward Allan Baker, he did a great job, but it was a one-act playwriting class.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know how to sustain full-length structure. And I didn't know how to, I was doing great work, but beyond the 60 pages, I didn't really know how to do
right.
that. So then the next few years, I was experimenting with that, and what held me there were cool groups like the Soho Rep Writer Director Lab. I was getting a lot of things. I didn't realize at the time, like, I was always thinking again, where's the sun god to come and take me to Playwrights Horizons? But I really didn't understand that I had all the tools. It's very Wizard of Oz. I had all the tools right there. I wasn't using them. I didn't think they would go away. I didn't know what was happening next. I didn't understand that not only is it the play that I'm working on and the team and the great people I'm meeting, but also it's how I use those tools and how I communicate and what I'm trying to say in my plays and where I want to go next. And because it was all just happening. In your 20s, it all just kind of feels like it's happening, and you're trying to make a narrative of it, mm-hmm. and it's very difficult.
Right, yeah.
And I think you're also still trying sometimes to create a narrative based on other people's work and their lives, and you don't have your full identity yet.
Right, you still think that there is a path because you you choose a playwright, and you say, that's how they did it, so that's how you do it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we're not fully aware yet because you haven't met enough people or probably had enough conversations yet. Maybe you had. I mean, like, if you're a 21-year-old and this is all you did and these are the conversations you always had and you've been in the business, you're in a different place. But if you're anybody else who's even just coming out with the MFA, you have to have time creating the work,
mm-hmm.
and you have to work. You know, so that's a whole other ballgame, right? The players that have to work, the players that don't have to work, right? So that's a different relationship of time. So by the time you get into your early 30s, that's when you're really starting to look at, wait, what was the pattern before? Where am I going? What are my decisions? And so I just started to kind of take more control, kind of like an artistic director of my own life,
mm-hmm.
And start to make strong decisions about what I wanted next and what I wanted to do and how to communicate that. And I do not believe I would know how to do that to the extent I do if I hadn't started working as a book writer in musical theater on a musical called Mary Max with composer Bobby Cronin about 5 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so I think I was getting there and I was having success, like when I wrote for those ensembles, because then all of a sudden I have 3 New York Times critic picks because I have productions. I'm writing for production, which was a different ball game,
mm-hmm.
because I was writing knowing the play would be produced. I thought then that was the next level, and then I thought Playwrights Horizons, where are you? And then I thought they were going to come there, and so I thought then cool, then I will have a career and I can work a little less. But when that didn't happen, and how I can say that didn't happen for me, because it has a happy end to the story, so I'll tell you the sad part first. The work was all great. Audiences came, sold out. I didn't realize until after that time and that was about 5 years that I was steadily working and having plays produced, writing knowing they would be produced, the industry didn't come. The theaters, the literary managers, the artistic directors did not come to see those plays.
Mm-hmm.
There were 4 out of 3 productions in New York. There were 4 that came. And they're great, and they're still my friends to this day, and they just came to open, which is awesome. And I know they'll always be there for me. But why? I hadn't outreached as directly as I could have, maybe. I didn't communicate as much that you have to see this now. Theater is also ephemeral, and not everyone can see at the same time. Everyone's overbooked and overscheduled. Their lives are so hard. There's so much going on for them. So I didn't know how to do all that at the time,
mm-hmm.
and I didn't actually understand you even needed to do it. I just thought, Jesus Christ, you know, people are talking about it. It's getting all these glowing reviews. Aren't you going to come down?
Right.
And
you should be self-motivating. They should be scanning the community and saying, what's hot right now? Who do I need to see?
Yeah, and I mean, one of the biggest things I'd love to fight for in theater is that I think there's so many good people moving into artistic director positions, associate artistic director positions, and literary manager positions. I wish that they had more people helping and supporting them so that they had more time to go see shows. And they do. They make it work.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, have even more capacity for that. It might be improving because I did the reverse of what happened with what I just described with Open. I did outreach to everyone personally. I was aware that their schedules are hard. I put in the time to make sure that they could come, make sure they fully understood the schedule, and they all did come. So it was a different experience. Now, it might have been because of all the work before as well, and that this is a very special piece. Megan Hill was in it. It's a magic show without magic, about the relationship of two women. There was a lot of energy around it, which was so great. It was directed by Jesse D. Hill at the Tank. So there was just something else happening with that play. But also I knew not to lean back. I knew not to say, hey, man, I did the play. You know, you're going to read this Times Rave. I know you're going to be there. I know that you don't know anything in this world, and you can't assume, and nothing is certain, and people don't know something special until you build it and show it to them. And that's what I think specifically I learned from the musicals, is that you would give someone a script, they'll listen to the demo. If you're really lucky, someone's like, this is electric, okay, great, you know, but most, and they do actually, but the next step is they want to hear it, and they want to see it, and they want to experience it in real time. And once I realized that that's the way it kind of worked,
mm-hmm.
for good or bad, because a lot of your own royalty money goes back into investing that
right.
with the team, right? Or you have to get people involved even to highlight and do that to pay the actors. I realized, oh, they want to live through the story. They want to be a part of it. So I understand, like, when you have something you really believe in and you really believe it's valuable, fight to have people see it. Because in theater, it's only here for a hot second, and then it goes. And so I think that's the biggest lesson most recently mm-hmm. that I've kind of been able to learn and apply.
And Open only closed, like, a couple weeks ago, right? So
yes.
So it's...
It was quick.
It's quick, but it also, like, all this work that you did, it's too soon to see the fruits that it
True.
Can bear, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit more about Open? I so regret not seeing it because my trip to New York was after it closed, but it's a one-person show, magic without magic.
Yep.
Question mark somewhere in there.
This is one of the, and we talked a little bit about how I've written plays, and this was, I think, a marriage of all parts of me, like mm-hmm. even the old dreamer me. I mean, I'm always still a dreamer, but before all the practicality of life happened, when I wrote this, I the magician came. So I was just writing, and I had this open visual, and the magician. So there was a magician on stage, and the magician was speaking to me, and the magician was telling about the relationship of their lover while doing magic.
Mm-hmm.
But even then, in that as that was coming to me, I realized that the magic you didn't see it, and so it was a pantomime.
Okay.
So it would be a matter of like, oh, are you ready? Here we go. Flowers! Oh, they're pink. Do you see it?
Right.
Oh, you don't see it. And then it crumbles in the magician's hand. What's not even there? You need a word. You need abracadabra. Okay, here we go. That means as it is spoken. Okay, now when I say this word, then you'll see what I see. Abracadabra. And then we learned in this production, we added a sound effect. Shoo! Nothing's there again, but there's the sound of something. So slowly, design started to layer in little rewards for the audience, so they really felt like they were seeing the objects, the rope trick that she mm-hmm. does in front of them, where she cuts it in half and she makes it one long rope. But each of these acts and each of these magic tricks illuminate a story about her lover that you're realizing she's telling to us because her lover's in the hospital because there was a hate crime the night before.
Mm-hmm.
So the stakes are quite high. It's not until, and I'm going to spoil it for you guys because you should read it and ask me for the play and all that good stuff. And hopefully there'll be a limited New York run later. But there's a big reveal in the play as to why she's prepping us so much as an audience for this. We knew we were the imagined audience in her mind. That we knew from the beginning of the play. What we didn't know is she's gathered us here to try and save Jenny. Because if we believe in the magic, then she'll live.
Mm.
And she believes that.
Mm.
So now that investment is a whole other level. Now, I didn't know what I was doing at the time. I had this, it was coming through in the writing, and then I was realizing I liked this concept and started to craft it over 3 years, you know, as a play with Megan and Jesse. But I didn't know what I was doing at the time. It was technically a reverse Tinkerbell effect. I knew it was Tinkerbell-like,
mm-hmm.
and I started to really read about that, and it was amazing when I was like, wow, this really is a perfect, beautiful metaphor for how we can use theater, because it is about not just... That's why it's a one-person play and not a one-person show, because everyone in the audience has to rely on each other. There are moments where the house lights are up a little so you can also see each other.
Mm-hmm.
She comes out into the audience. She'll make you hand you an egg, which is there but is not there,
right.
and you have the responsibility to hold that egg until it... hatches into a bird, right?
Uh-huh.
So like, which we hear through sound effect and how she leads us. So it really is an investment where you can see your fellow audience members at certain points too. So you know, well, that person better believe too, because I want to believe, because I don't want the love of her life to die. And I also
right.
know the stakes are so much that it's been difficult for her to share who she is in New York City and with the world. As much as she loves New York City, she's not fully open.
Mm.
And so the whole thing that Jenny is always pushing her to do is to be open in their relationship, open with who they are. And so it talks a lot about how also you can suffer from that and that the city is somewhat responsible for that, that we all are. So hopefully people leave and say, what could I do better? Where can I stand up? And I'm really obsessed with, and I love it that you're in Chicago. Like, I love it that you've been in so many cities across the country, because one of the things I'm kind of obsessed with is how theater can play and change people, but not through saying it's the message and not through preaching the message. and not through a direct theme like we took transcripts. And I mean, I think that stuff's all great.
Right,
I need to down
right,
that stuff.
Sure.
But what this can do is that it slips into it in a way that, like, if you have a daughter who is with a woman and you're supportive, but in your heart, not so sure you feel about it, or you're sitting there and your religion tells you something different, or you heard something on the street and you didn't stand up for the person at the time, it's going to change you. The experience mm-hmm. is going to change you because you care, you mm-hmm. know? And I think you take that with you as you leave. And everyone's had such a different experience. Holly Harms, who wrote a beautiful review, she was sobbing at the end of it, and she for the front page, she grabbed me, and she's a playwright with EST, and she was sobbing. She just kept saying, I'm a mother, I'm a mother, I'm a mother. So everyone's relating to a different part of the story that opens up for them what love is love means and what it means to strive for that. And for the LGBTQ community, I think it was a really beautiful piece that reminds, you know, how the world needs to stand up for you and how the world needs to be there for you. And that's magic, is that relationship. Mm. And so I think there's a lot of beauty in that story. And, you know, it was in Pride Month, which we're really proud of, obviously. But also I was aware, like, I was like, there's so much celebration going on. This is a beautiful, fun play, but also it deals with tragedy, you know, and yeah. how do we deal with that? But so many of my friends said, no, 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 but this is reminding me of what I fight for. This is reminding me of why we celebrate. This is reminding me. And I think it was very apropos that it happened, you know, in the 50th anniversary of Stonewall. Like, there was just something surrounding the piece as well with that. And here in the city, it's been a glorious month in time. And I know that on Sunday, it was just something really, truly magical here. And hearing people post about their own relationship with Stonewall and their own mission statement, so to speak, or what they want other people to think about or engage with. I think we saw a beautiful thing on social media too, or in the room, a boldness that is obviously needed because we're in a big fight here in this country that's only going to get deeper. So it was a good moment. It was a good moment. It feels like too for like the rebels to like come together, get our energy because. As the election's coming up, it's going to be a big fight.
Well, I'm glad it was such a big success, and I'm glad it was a New York Times. I'm glad things that don't matter came out positive.
Yes, and you can only hope and pray. You know, you're not in control of this stuff, and I do think so. I'm good friends with James Comtois, Mac Rogers, Qui Gwynn, and I. We were all part of that Vampire Cowboys Saloon.
Right.
Dustin Chin, Carla Chang as well. James said something I just love, which he said, they're just pull quotes.
Yeah.
So I always have that in my mind. I always know it's just pull quotes. And so I'm always kind of prepared for, I don't actually read them. I have my husband read them or someone I care about and reflect back to me. And then I'll know if I can read it. But this was an experience, Brian, I've never had before as a playwright. It was like a real, oh my God, a real like almost political moment because we were in the bar. I actually had anxiety all day because I knew that they had come and I knew the review was going to come out right after opening or on opening day.
Yeah.
So we opened
and
open. We are at, what was it? The Houndstooth Tavern for the after, you know, party, the
right.
celebration with All for One and the Tank and all the producers are there and Megan, Jesse and I are there and all our friends are there. A lot of great playwrights are there. And Nick, you know, our producer just is like, it's up. Like, I'm just like, holy fuck, this is going to happen right now. This is going to happen live. And I was already like, the relationship, because, you know, oh my God. John Guare, help me.
Comfort in the numbers and being around amongst people when
no!
it comes out? Or did you?
I was fucking scared shitless. I was like, because here's the thing is that I do know that you can create something beautiful and good and understand that relationship and then engage perhaps with an audience member that didn't like it or something. And like, and I didn't have to with this show, which is kind of amazing. But, you know, then you can have a conversation about it and you can say, I see your point, but this is where
sure.
I'm at. Or I don't want to engage with you. I made what I made.
Right.
The critics are a whole other ballgame because they're looking at it from so many, and they affect things in such different ways and their agendas are so different. So it's not something, so I know it's great. But and that's the thing is that people was like, this is so great. You're going to get a rave, right? I was like, are you kidding me? Like, you cannot predict anything,
right?
How is that even possible? So I was scared shitless because you just don't know, you know? It's like going to the doctor. Like, you don't know. Like, you're like, I feel great today. But like, who the fuck knows? You know, like, so it just was, I'm a hypochondriac too, if you can't tell. So as it was happening, I was like, oh my God. And then he just was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. And then everyone, and then the other producer was going, oh my God, oh my God. And then I just handed my phone to Fred. He looked at it and he goes, it's terrific. And I was, and then everyone just screamed. People were like on the bar. People were hugging each other. It was like confetti had come from the sky. And I guess it was one of those little moments in your life where it's like little big moments where it's like the ladies won.
Yeah.
It's like the ladies won because it was an all-female team. Jessie D. Hill worked her ass off and put together an incredible, I mean, that Elma Wilk with sound, you know, Sarah Johnston with lights. I mean, it was Becky with costumes. I mean, this was a crackerjack all-female team. And when we worked together on that week of tech, I never experienced anything like it because no one held back and no one was offended ever, and everyone was honest and everyone was doing the right thing and trying to get the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no passive aggressiveness. There was just something about this team and that energy. And so to have that win and to see also, you know, this was a big thing for me in the play, but also for Megan, who'd been consistently climbing, been noticed in New York. I've seen her other two performances in Eddie and Dave, and also Do You Feel Anger, which extraordinary plays.
Mm-hmm.
Rising, noticed. And then this one just said, yeah, she's here, you know, and that was amazing. So I really appreciate it. I also appreciate when a review actually is trying to do something, and that's what a lot of people were surprised by. I think it gave a little faith in the critics again. And she took two paragraphs, one for me and one for Megan, talking about our careers.
Yeah.
Because she knows how hard it is. And
right.
There was something about that, like as a woman writer, I could just feel like she was like, why don't you know these ladies? You know what? I'm going to tell you why maybe you didn't, and don't fuck up again.
Yeah, I think the thing the critics owe us the consumers the most is the thing they do the least, which is providing context for why they feel a certain way about a play.
Agreed.
Or a portion of a play, of the writing or a performance, giving us context, because then it goes beyond just simply their opinion. You know, they're informing us on how their opinion is formed.
And
think they do that so
us.
Rarely. It's so rare. So I'm glad that they took the time for you and Megan and Jesse.
It was
all
just
three
a magical,
of you, right?
It was magic.
Right. And I'm just glad that this happened in general because you work so hard.
Oh, thank
and I'm
you.
Such a big fan and a huge supporter of you.
We're such good friends, too.
And
I'm
hope
so glad
that
you're here right now.
This keeps happening over and over and over again.
Thank you. Well, you know, it can't, right, necessarily.
It can't, but I can still hope for
it. You can hope for it. But I do know, and what I didn't know before is how to use your downtime. So those 5 years I described of being in prison, I said, when I come out of prison, my image actually also, I'm so like 70s, I think it might even be a 60s movie, as I love motorcycles. So my image was Steve McQueen with the baseball and The Great Escape.
Uh-huh.
And I just said, I'm not going to be here forever. And I was just throwing that baseball, and I was like, I've just got to be strong for when I get out of this downtime. And so Open was created in this downtime, and I kept working on that workshop wise. Mary and Max, Rain and Zoe Save the World, which is starting to get some notice, and Pulp Verite, my new play, which is the first play to go out to off-Broadway in a long time, so hopefully we'll hear a bit more about it soon, and it made the Killeries list. So that all came from 5 years of just... You know, and you know, it's hard to take because you go to parties and people are like, what's happening? And you're like, I believe that in 5 years, I'm
going to,
you know,
right.
I don't know. I don't know. I believe that soon I will be out of prison and I will have great work to show you. And they're like, oh, well, that
sounds
cool.
Let me tell you about
playwright prison. Call me up when that
prison.
Happens.
they're just like, I just wanted you to say something nice.
Jeez, I just want to know if you like the cheese and the crackers, you know?
Quickly, can you tell us when the world will see Mary and Max?
It has its European premiere in Austria this November at Theater Linz.
That's rad.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting. And it's going to be in German. I've never had that happen before. That's going to be cool. We're going over to Austria
super
to see
Super titles?
It. I don't I hope so. I'm not quite sure. I do know that they do subtitles for the play itself. Like, they're really into communicating about it. And Mary Max, for those that don't know, is a beautiful musical about coping with depression and finding your light. And it's a girl who is having a really rough day, but we learn how rough it is, locks her door, her father can't get in. He chooses to tell her the story of Mary Max, which is about two friends. Ups and downs over 20 years. A girl in Australia whose mom is a kleptomaniac and an alcoholic, and Max, who's actually 55 years old, who doesn't realize he has Asperger's syndrome in New York, and about how their communication changes each other, and it's about how we need to communicate to each other to find connection. So it's a piece that we debuted in Canada, and then we did these rewrites, which are great, that we're going to see in Theatre Austria, at Theatre Linz. And then now we are working on the American track of it. So we're in talks right now with interested producers, and we have some great guidance on that with where the show will be seen next in America, because we're looking to do like two out-of-town tryouts. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, the road has always been Broadway, just in the sense that we would like it to reach as many people as possible.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Me too.
Yeah. Thank you. Then you'll be in the front row.
Yeah, you bet I will. Thank you for giving me some of your time.
Thank you for asking me.
I'm glad we finally
were able to. I'm so excited about the subtext.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, Crystal. I have to say I had a bonus extra fun time with her because she walked me along the waterfront and showed me around her neighborhood. As you heard her mention, Crystal wrote the book for the musical Mary and Max. Be on the lookout for that when it opens. She has so many awesome plays. I recommend you go to the Google, plug in her name, and find some of them. Thank you for listening. Please go rate and review the subtext on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find podcasts. It really helps us connect with more people. You can find us on Twitter at Subtext Podcast. And if you are a person who wants to send me emails, you can do so. TheSubtextPodcast@gmail.com. The music from this episode is by Blue Dot Sessions. The theme song for the subtext is from International Pen Pal. The subtext is produced, edited, and hosted by yours truly, and presented by American Theater Magazine, a program of Theater Communications Group. The play filling me up this month is The Vanishing Point by David Narder. This is a dark, funny, and scary play about what happens if the lives we curate through our social media manifested into actual people. It's terrifying. Go give it a read on New Play Exchange.